Coming up, we got a loaded episode. I got James Worthy on the podcast. Never expected to interview the legend James Worthy. We talked about the Lakers, how much he still hates the Celtics, and a lot else. We got Tim Bontemps talking about some of the most intriguing offseason teams around the NBA. We got Evan Wash talking about the future of the NBA draft. And I close the show with my full first round mock draft. We got game two later tonight of the NBA Finals. I'll be reacting to that game with a recording on Saturday. So look for a special edition weekend episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show talking about game two. And plus, we got some more other guests coming from this week here at the NBA Finals. That's all coming up right now on the Kevin O'Connor Show. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Before we get started, wanted to let you know that Yahoo's all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. So please be sure to join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. Now joining me from ESPN, Tim Bontemps. Tim, what's up?
What's up, KOC? How you doing, bud?
Podcasting together. We've never done this.
I know, man. It's nice. It's pretty cool.
So we're going to look ahead to the offseason here, our four most intriguing offseason teams.
Okay.
What do you got? Start us off.
I mean, I think you have to start with the Oklahoma City Thunder, right? Obviously, you could start with the Bucks or the Giannis, but when you look at the fact that the Thunder are coming off this series where they just lost to the Spurs, obviously everybody thought pretty all season we were going to be back in Oklahoma City again. So they've got to try to catch the Spurs, which is the first part of the challenge. What do they have to do to get better? And then they have all these massive decisions to make, right? Obviously, what are they going to do with Isaiah Hartenstein and Lu Dort? Two team options for those guys. I think there's a pretty good chance they decline Kendrick Williams' team option, probably get him back on a cheaper deal, maybe a minimum deal. That saves a few more million dollars. But right now, they're somewhere between $30 and $40 million over the second apron if they bring everybody back on their current salaries. They're probably not going to be $30, $40 million over the second apron. So what do they come up with for a deal for Hartenstein? What do they decide to do with Dort? What do they do on a Case and Wallace extension? What do they do to try to upgrade this roster to try to take on the Spurs team? Because as you know, the Spurs are young. They're only going to get better. They've got a lot of assets. And this crew is all going to be here, right? So you know what you're chasing trying to beat Victor Wembanyama. What are these guys going to do to get better? Because clearly they weren't good enough to win.
I think along those same lines, I'm thinking about Denver. Denver, you have still one of the best players in the world in Nikola Jokic. You have a very good supporting cast with one of those players you were without this postseason, Peyton Watson, who looked like a future all-star in the weeks Jokic was.
He had one of the great, he had sort of the Lin Sanity like two or 3 weeks where he's unbelievable and then we just basically didn't see him again.
Exactly. He was out, and how much do you trust that? How much is a team going to try to pay him in restricted free agency?
Will somebody think they can overpay him and get him out of Denver since we know Denver is not going to go deep into the aprons?
Exactly. And so is Denver going to have to tear down their roster because they're cheap in order to keep Peyton Watson, or are they just going to let Peyton Watson talk and say, you know what, you're overpaying him?
Well, and by the way, there's one other thing. Is Nikola Jokic going to sign the Supermax extension? Now, he has said he wants to be in Denver forever, but a few years ago when he had the first chance to sign this extension, what did he do? He said, I'm going to sign the extension, and then he signed it. He has not said, I'm going to sign the extension. So the first question for me for Denver is he going to sign the extension? Now, he may, you know, be over in Serbia and just sign the thing on July 1st or whenever he's officially able to sign it. But that to me is one of the biggest questions of the whole summer. Like, will he sign it? And then what happens if he doesn't? Now, I think he's going to, but until he says I'm signing it and we see him sign it, I'm at least going to wonder if it's going to happen or not.
He's at least in a position right now where he should at least think about it, right?
I mean, it depends on what his goals are. Like, if he wants to just be in Denver, sure, great, be in Denver. But if he wants to look at, okay, do I want to have the best chance to win a championship? It's going to be hard to do that in Denver with where they sit and where this team sits and where Oklahoma City sits. Like, the rest of these teams in the West have a lot of work to do.
And it will be interesting because this is a guy who has said he wants to be a Denver lifer, but he also said that at a time where it felt like Denver was going to be contending forever. And now we're at a point where it's like, maybe not so much. So for a guy who does have a chance to become one of the 10 greatest players in NBA history, but needs another ring, maybe you do have to go somewhere else to get it, but who knows? Maybe Denver could do something else to turn things around.
It will be really interesting. And like you said, one of the interesting pivot points of the summer will be, you know, assuming Jokic extends, do they want to keep Peyton Watson? If so, how do they do it, right? Because in theory, They're not going to have Peyton Watson, Cam Johnson, and Christian Brown on the team. So do they move on from Christian Brown? Do they move on from Cam Johnson to keep Peyton Watson? Do they let Peyton Watson leave? Do they do a sign and trade? Does he get overbid on and leave in free agency? That will be an interesting thing. Because like you said, they were not good enough already. And now you're maybe going into the summer and not keeping this whole team that you already had that probably wasn't good enough. So definitely real questions to watch for in Denver.
What's your next team, Tim?
I mean, we'll go to Milwaukee. I think you have to, right? Unfortunately, we're back in this same circular thing with Giannis. Will he get traded? Will he not get traded? Obviously, if Giannis does get traded, that is the single biggest domino short of Nikola Jokic that could really change in the league this summer. And then that gets into, where does he go? Does he go to Miami? Does he go to Orlando? Does he go to Cleveland? Does he go to Boston? Does he go somewhere else, right? Like, whatever trade happens with Giannis, in theory, it will probably end up being a 3 or 4 team trade, just because, as you know, with the new apron rules, every trade almost has to become a 3 or 4 team trade with a salary that big. And then if it does happen, okay, what are all the ripple effects of that, right? That's why, you know, I thought when you go back to Taylor Jenkins' introductory press conference, Jimmy Haslam, the co-owner of the Bucks, to me, laid it out pretty clearly. They're either going to trade Giannis by the draft, or they're going to pivot and make moves to try to keep Giannis. So then, okay, if they do keep Giannis and they don't trade him by the draft, well, then they've got 3 first-round picks. They've got some big expiring money. Can they go out and make some moves to make the team better, right? So I think one way or the other, Milwaukee's at the center of a lot of what's going to happen in the NBA this offseason, and we'll probably know between now and the draft what's going to happen with Giannis, which will set up a lot of other things.
I'm glad you hit on the possibility of he still stays a Buck, because I think everybody assumes he's going to be gone.
Well, they haven't traded him yet, and if he's on the team on October 1st, I think he's going to sign the extension. So to me, this is a Milwaukee Bucks question. Do the Bucks look at it and say, we don't have a path to contention now? We've done this dance the last few years of like, will he stay or won't he stay? And we need to just shake hands, say, this has been an unbelievable run. There'll be a statue, the best Buck ever. Your jersey's going to be retired. All this is great, but we've got to turn the page and move forward. Or do they say, all right, look, we're going to sign Giannis to this extension. He's going to be a Buck. We're going to do the best we can to make this work. And then we're going to go try to use our draft picks to get better. And that, whatever way they go with that decision, is going to lead to a lot of movement. And obviously, to me, makes them one of the most interesting teams to watch in the league.
I want to stick with a team in the top 10 because I feel like there's a lot of focus on the top 4. There's a lot of focus on the Clippers at 5 because they got the pick from Indiana. There's focus on like the Nets as a young team. There's focus on a bunch of teams, obviously, in the top 10. What are the Mavericks going to do at number 9? The team that I feel like nobody ever talks about is Atlanta at 8. Mm-hmm. They just made the playoffs. Mm-hmm. They had a really good year.
Yep.
They made a huge trade getting rid of Trae Young. CJ McCollum had a great year. They had the most improved player in Nickeil Alexander-Walker.
Yep.
They're in a great spot, and they have the 8th pick this year.
Yeah.
And that's a spot in this year's draft, which is pretty loaded. But I think Atlanta is in a position to either let's keep building young, let's not rush things, or to be in a spot where it's like, hey, we have this highly valuable asset. We have multiple picks. Let's do something. Let's do something big. So I'm intrigued by the paths Atlanta could go this offseason.
Yeah, the Hawks are in a really interesting spot, right? They've got the 8th pick. They've got the 23rd pick, which they got as part of a different deal in the draft. So they got 2 first-round picks in this year's draft, which, as you said, is still very good. It's going to be interesting what they do there. They have to decide what they're going to do with Jonathan Kuminga. He had some interesting moments down the stretch. But I think the main reason you trade for Jonathan Kuminga at the trade deadline is to have a big expiring contract on that team option this summer to potentially go out and make some moves, right? You mentioned the Trae Young trade. Getting out of that Trae Young contract looks pretty good right now. However, you did see, especially in that Knicks series, Atlanta had a lot of trouble in the half court generating offense. So do they go get a player with that 8th pick, you know, whether it's Mikael Brown or Keaton Wagler or Kingston Flemings or any of these guys, you know, Darius Akoff, one of these guards to be the guy that's maybe the next, you know, floor general for them going forward. Do they go a different direction of that pick? Do they move back and get some more assets? Do they trade it for some impact veteran player now, right? They still have a bunch of trade exceptions and different salary exceptions they can go. If they do decline Kuminga's option, they can go a lot of different ways there. You know, it seems like it's pretty likely they'll probably have McCollum back on some deal, I would think. But yeah, like, you know, they just extended Ansi Slay, their GM, gave him a deserved bump up to president, gave him a long-term deal. We'll see if they get an extension done with Quinn Snyder. But the Hawks are in the middle of a lot of stuff, and it it will be interesting to see what direction they go, because they do, like you said, Jalen Johnson's in his early 20s. Dyson Daniels is a young guy, and Onyeka Okongwu is a good player. They can have a choice on him to extend him this summer. He's a terrific player. Obviously, Zachary Risha had a disappointing second year. Hopefully, he'll be able to bounce back and play better. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things going on there, up to and including what are they going to do on draft night. So they are a team that I think is flying under the radar, but in an Eastern Conference where there's a lot of things going on, the Hawks are an interesting team to watch for sure.
Definitely. I mean, I think with the new draft system as well, it's going to be very interesting to see the way in which certain teams value their future picks and how that changes the possible trades that could be out.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see if teams, like, to me, there's one or two ways you can go with that, right? One is you can basically lean into it and say, we have no idea where these picks are going to go. So if people really value the picks, let's use them to go get impact players, right? Because an average pick now has more value than it did before because there's a higher chance of it jumping up. On the other hand, you could see teams say, well, because there's a higher chance of it jumping up, we're going to really rein it in and wait and see, especially because we don't know this is only going to be the system for a couple of years, and then maybe it's going to change again in 2030. So I am just generally very interested to see what the game theory of the draft is over the next couple of years, because you know, and one school of thought might be to try to hoard as many picks as you can. Another might be, hey, these picks individually are more valuable than ever, so we can maybe get more value out of them in trade than we could have otherwise. So that push and pull and how teams evaluate that, I do think is going to be very interesting. It could have a big impact on some of these kind of deals we're talking about, because say, you know, if you're a team like Milwaukee, all of a sudden, I think it's like usually in the past, you know, Kevin, like a lot of times teams look at these trades and say, we need to get our picks back, right? Because like the Nets, they made that trade with Houston because the Nets are like, we got to make sure we can control where we get in the draft, even though it didn't end up working out great. Now it's like, well, if we just get some picks, well, who knows where they're going to wind up, right? So if you're talking about like a Giannis trade, for example, they don't necessarily have to engage with, say, Portland, which has a bunch of Bucks picks, because maybe the Bucks picks will jump up, or maybe the Bucks picks will be the 15th pick in the draft. But if they get five picks from a bunch of teams, it might end up having more value to them than it would have in the past just trying to get their own stuff back. So there's a lot of things like that that could have a really interesting impact on the offseason. Very interested to see where that goes.
I really can't wait, especially like a team like Detroit. They waited. They didn't make a deal during the season, and now they have all of their picks in the future. Are they going to cash those in? Could that turn out to be a mistake? Could it turn out to be the right choice? It's impossible to predict. I don't think anybody has the answers because we don't know what the system's going to look like.
No, I mean, the sunsetting of it, I do think, is weird, and that you already know it's only going to be a couple of years. But, like, look, you just casually mentioned Detroit. They've got a ton of big questions to answer. What are they going to do with Arsar Thompson as an extension? What are they going to do with Jalen Duren as a restricted free agent? Are they going to make a big move to try to add another perimeter creator, which obviously they desperately needed, and that showed in the playoffs, right? The team that beat them, the Cleveland Cavaliers, what are they going to do? I think they're going to get a deal done with James Harden, but they have to get this Donovan Mitchell extension done. They have to decide, are they going forward with this group? Are they going to radically change it? There's really only one way to do that, which is trading Evan Mobley. If they put Evan Mobley on the trade block, that's a guy that has a ton of value that could really get them in a lot of interesting conversations, right? Orlando just hired Sean Sweeney off the Spurs, but that's a team that's disappointed the last couple of years. What did they try to do? Do they try to get better? We haven't talked at all about Minnesota. They have a ton of interesting stuff ahead. Like, what are they going to do? Do they decide to trade some of these bigs to try to balance out the roster? Do they try to go get a point guard to play with Anthony Edwards, some other creator? Can they get Ayo Dosunmu re-signed? Are they going to be able to keep Dante DiVincenzo? Or do they have to move him? As obviously, he's unfortunately out with the Achilles. We haven't even mentioned the Lakers. There's the whole LeBron James question. What's all going to happen with Austin Reeves, right? Like, this summer is going to be pretty fascinating. And especially if the San Antonio Spurs win, and a team with a 22-year-old superstar, with the two co-stars on the team both being in their rookie and second years of their deals, like, that is a pretty gigantic mountain to have to climb. You know, it's just going to be fascinating to see what all these teams do. We haven't talked about Boston either. I mean, I think it's got a chance to be a very fascinating summer with a lot of stuff happening across the league. And, you know, going into the playoffs, a lot of my conversations you probably had similar were about there are a lot of teams, because of how wide open the league felt, that thought they had a chance this year. And if there's 5, 6, 8 teams that think they can make the conference semifinals or the conference finals, and then 3 or 4 or 5 teams that think they can make the conference finals or the finals in each conference. There's only so many teams that can actually get into those conversations, right? And when you are disappointed in the playoffs, that typically leads to change. And I think this summer's got a chance to have a lot of change, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see what that means.
I can't wait, Tim. Best time of the year. Finals, draft, offseason, all coming up.
Yeah, it's a crazy month, but it's awesome.
Can't wait. Tim, thank you so much for joining me.
Anytime, dude. Appreciate it.
Up next, got James Worthy joining the Kevin O'Connor Show. All right, now joining me, NBA Hall of Famer, Lakers legends, champion, James Worthy. What's going on, James?
Hey, how are you? Here we are in San Antonio for the 2026 finals. It's exciting.
I want to start off with you with a team that's not here, your Los Angeles Lakers. As you watch these two teams, we'll see in the finals, the Spurs, and of course, the Knicks. We saw the Thunder sweep the Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
What are the missing ingredients with the Lakers to be here at this stage over the next couple of years?
Well, I think number one, they have to keep enough players together over a period of time so that they're building chemistry and building good habits. And I think they were on their way to doing that the last couple of years, obviously bringing in Luka, the emergence of Austin Reeves and guys like Rui Hachimura. But I think that what's missing is, you know, a big. Ayton is a big that has some skills, but I don't think the skills that can, you know, quantify what we need from a center. We need a rugged center that can rebound and that can accommodate what Luka and LeBron and Austin and those guys are doing. So, and we need role players. We need a better bench, 3-and-D guys. 6'6", 6'8", who can shoot the three and come in and provide instant offense. That's what you're seeing from the teams that are emerging and the teams that are consistent. They have those things.
I mean, it's interesting you mention Ayton. Obviously, he was a discount addition, a worthy addition. And in some ways, he exceeded what he's getting paid. But on the other hand, he is not fulfilling what is necessary from a big man in today's NBA. It's funny how things kind of circled back. The big man has come back in a big way the last 4 or 5 years. Wow. Of course, you have Wemby in the finals. Last year, it's, you know, double big with Chet, Isaiah Hartenstein. Mm-hmm. Year before that, Boston with Porzingis and Horford. So many different combinations and so many shapes and sizes able to play in the front court. Ayton doesn't necessarily have that dog in him. My question with the Lakers is, and this is my concern with them, if they're going to pay Austin Reeves whatever it is that he's going to get paid, can they fill all those other gaps in the roster that are going to be needed? As you said, finding all those wings, finding that big man. I worry in today's day and age that it's going to be really hard to fill those defensive gaps for the Lakers around a core with Luka and Reeves getting as paid as much as they would be.
Yeah, that is the question. Will that happen? You know, Reeves is expected to get a nice bag this year. Hasn't been done yet. And that's a decision that I think the Lakers are going to have to make, because if they do give him the money that he's expected to get, then you're going to have issues not being able to bring in. So the Lakers have a big decision to make. Are they going to, you know, allow Reeves to go out in the free market and free up some money? What are they going to do with LeBron? Are they going to pay LeBron a max deal or not? Is he going to accept that? And so those are the decisions that they are currently making. They're bringing in new assistant GMs. So if they're going to keep Reeves, then they will be somewhat stuck with a similar situation, having to depend on Ayton and Jackson Hayes. They might be able to get a moderate big, but not the big that I think they need to get to the promised land they're trying to get to.
Now, I mentioned kind of like that mindset, having that dog in you, your nickname, Big Game James. You've authored some of the best games we've seen in finals history. That mindset, that big game mindset, can that be taught, or is that just something like you, for example, always had since you were a kid?
It's kind of innate in you. For me, you know, the regular season was really difficult. You know, you're traveling a lot, and we flew commercial, and you might have Larry Bird on a Tuesday night. You fly over to New York, you have Bernard King, take Thursday off, come back on Friday to have Dr. J. So it's hard during the regular season. But when you get a team for seven games, and that's the only team you have to worry about, you got two or three players that you're focused on, a lot of video, a lot of study time. I always thought that my, you know, postseason should be better. Always expected it. And I trained to do that, watched a lot of my opponents. It doesn't happen by accident. You have to put in the work. But to me, I just enjoyed rising to the occasion, especially, you know, being the third guy behind, you know, Kareem and Magic, just waiting for my opportunity.
You mentioned being the third guy. You come in as a number one pick with a team that already has Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on it. What's the mindset going into a situation like that, and how do you find your lane without necessarily disturbing what those guys already had?
Not only that, they had Hall of Famer Jamal Wilkes. They had Hall of Famer Bob McAdoo. They had Hall of Famer Michael Cooper. And that's what Jerry West wanted. Rarely does a number one draft pick go to the best team, but due to a trade they made with Cleveland years ago,
a coin flip
between the Clippers and the Lakers, and Bill Sharman, they chose, they didn't really need a score, because if they did, they probably would have taken Dominique Wilkins or Terry Cummins. They needed a role player, someone that could fit in. And so it was perfect for me. I didn't have to come in and be the franchise player, even though you may have lost a little bit of scoring and attention and endorsement and things like that. But I won three championships and achieved everything I could possibly achieve for a guy who really only wanted a college scholarship out of this.
You probably wouldn't have it any other way, right? But like, everybody's different. Some players, they just want to put up 30 points per game. They just want to get buckets. But that speaks to what you said about that innate mentality, yeah, the approach to the game. In your time, you know, with basketball throughout your life as a player, a broadcaster, everything you've done over the last 4+ decades, what are those qualities you look for in those person? Like for the Lakers, for example, surrounding a guy like Luka, what does the front office need to be looking for to best maximize him?
Shooters, particularly those who can hit the three consistently, guys who can defend and not necessarily, you know, hide him in the defense, but take a little bit of pressure off of him. They need a big who can protect the paint and also receive lobs and be a force defensively. And they need players around him who can also create. They need an Austin Reeves. LeBron was able to do it at 41 to take some pressure off of Luka when they start to blitz him. Teams will figure out a way to disrupt a guy like Luka or a guy like KD. So he needs guys, and I think he loves the fact that Austin Reeves is on the team because he loves what Austin does when he doesn't have the ball. But they need what Oklahoma has. When he's out of the game, they need a bench that can come in and put up 40, 50, 60 points from time to time. They need it consistently.
I mean, isn't the skill level in the NBA just so high nowadays where, like, every team, it seems like these contender-level teams have ball handling across positions, shooting across positions, defensive versatility across positions on the roster? I mean, that's what we're going to see in this finals with the Knicks and the Spurs. And I think that's what, like, the Thunder were missing without A.J. Mitchell, without Jalen Williams last round in their seven-game series loss against the Spurs. It's just so, like, that bar is so high nowadays, yeah, isn't it?
There's no more play calling. You know, back when I played, everybody had a play. And the coaches controlled, you know, the tempo. You had the unless there was a fast break. And we had specific plays, a play for Kareem, a play for Magic, a play for me. Now it's an open court. That's why you got to have 3-and-D guys who can handle the ball, multiple ball handlers who can pass, shoot, and get to the racket. And so I get to the rim. And so that's the way teams have been building over the last, I'll say, 7 to 8 years. You need multiple guys doing multiple things, guards that can rebound. When your guy goes to the bench like a Shea, you need guys like a McCain, a Wallace who can come in and still sustain that. And I think that's the way the league is growing, a superior athlete who's very versatile.
Along those lines, does Luka need to have the ball in his hands less?
For me, he's more of a target when he handles the ball a lot. I'm more for him initiating the offense and doing what he does. Sometimes I think, you know, it's 18, 20 seconds before he tries to make a pass. And that's just not really having the personnel. I think when you get the personnel and the ball is moving, I saw a play, San Antonio had 10 passes on one possession. And it touched the floor maybe once. And so when you have those type of players that can attack from every angle, like a Reeves, LeBron, Ruiz, he's getting there. And he's a great shooter. But when you have guys who can go downhill and, you know, collapse the defense, that's what the Lakers, I think that's what we need before he can get it out of his hands. With it in his hands, he can score. But I think sometimes players get lost a little bit when the ball needs to be moving.
I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, like, he's called Luka Magic for a reason, right? Like, he's brilliant with the ball in his hands. But at the same time, I still think back to pre-draft with Luka with Real Madrid. He would move off ball a little bit more. He cut a little bit playing overseas. And I'd like to see the Lakers integrate some of that. You mentioned LeBron. Do you think LeBron James will be back? Do you think he should be back for this roster to best maximize next year with Luka?
I didn't see too many players that played better than he did this year. And when I looked at his numbers and I looked at Shea's numbers, they were, I mean, I haven't seen any athlete like this. He loves L.A. His family loves L.A. And I think, you know, if the price is right, if you know, but, I, you know, he's a max player. The question is he willing to not be a max player and take less? Otherwise, I don't know. Because if he's got to get paid and Austin's got to get paid, then we're going to have to deal with similar situation we did this year. Which wasn't bad. I mean, we got to third or fourth. Without Luka against Oklahoma, we didn't have a chance. Didn't fare well when we had him. But they know what the missing pieces are. The Dodgers are coming in now with all the analytics and new, you know, people that are so smart. So we'll see some changes, I believe.
Do you still hate the Celtics?
As much as I did back then, I still hate them.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's never gone away.
It's not going to go away.
Wow.
The Celtics. Hate them.
You still take out the cigar after those wins.
If we win. I love Cedric Maxwell. He's a North Carolina guy. I love ML Carr. Mm-hmm. He's a North Carolina guy. I've had some conversations with Kevin. We don't hate each other, but we just fucking hate the Celtics. That's all.
Do you think the Celtics should trade Jaylen Brown for Giannis?
That would work.
Financially?
That would work if they still have Tatum, a healthy Tatum in the surround. That would work for them.
Yeah.
So I can't see anything wrong with that.
I think it would be a smart thing for them to do. Should the Lakers go for Giannis?
Yes, if we can do it.
Okay.
We'd have to get rid of some players. But we need him too. Everybody's going after Giannis. He still has some good years left. And he's one of those bigs that gets it done. So, yeah.
What is your single most fond memory from your Lakers-Celtics rivalry?
Beating them on their parquet floor in 1985. First time the Lakers ever beat the Celtics. Jerry West and Elgin Baylor and both those guys never did it. So not only were we representing ourselves, but we were representing all those haunted memories. And we had just lost the year before in 84. So it was a comeback, but that was it. No other team has won on that floor. And to be able to do it there was amazing.
Do you have a favorite Jerry West memory?
Love Jerry West, yeah. We both have the same initials, J-A-W. He never went back to Boston Garden. But Jerry was my biggest fan. And there was a trade rumors in 86. We lost to Houston in the Western Conference Finals, and they were looking to trade, perhaps. And Jerry West said, can't do it. He said, if you do it, I'll quit. And that's the story that would always stick with me, man. He gave a lot of brutal honesty, and we miss it. He's a great man.
James, thank you so much for joining
me.
I appreciate it.
It's a good one.
Thank you.
All right, you got it. All good.
Up next, Evan Wash from the NBA talking about NBA draft lottery reform and the future of the NBA draft. All right, now joining me from the NBA League office, the creator, the orchestrator of NBA draft lottery reform and a lot of other cool stuff the league does. It's Evan Walsh. Evan, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Well, draft lottery reform has passed.
Yeah.
Excited? How are you feeling about it?
Feeling good. Honestly, this was a lengthy process, but an accelerated one. We found this, you know, a bit of a crisis this year with some of the behavior that we saw. And so it necessitated some pretty dramatic change for next season. And so we worked with our stakeholders, our board of governors, team basketball folks, and settled on a reform that we really think is going to have a pretty big impact on behavior going forward.
I'm excited about it. I mean, obviously, like, there's, you know, nothing's perfect, I think, but 3-2-1 ultimately is going to hopefully eliminate the abomination that is tanking, right? But there's always loopholes. What are some of the things that the league is kind of watching out for over these next 3 years before it sunsets in 2029? That's just something to be aware of when it comes to loopholes.
So the way we thought about this was, as long as you tie record to draft position in some way, you can never fully eliminate the idea that a team might want to lose to improve their draft position, right? That if we're not giving all 30 teams equal chances or going to a wheel or something that just fully divorces, like, yes, the more you lose, the better position you might be in. But if you look at what 3-2-1 does at the bottom of the standings with draft relegation, it's an actual penalty to finish in the bottom three. And so not only will teams try to fight their way out of the bottom three, obviously the rest of the non-play-in field will try to stay above those three. And so you should see more competition at the bottom of the standings. We should also see more competition in the middle of the standings, because what happened under the current system is teams really had to make a choice between competing for the play-in or chasing lottery balls effectively. Now you can have a bit of best of both worlds, right? A team can be the 9th or 10th seed in the play-in. They can have their two lottery balls. They can make the playoffs and keep those two lottery balls. And so we should see more competition there. Does that mean that no team might strategically pivot in the middle of the year to avoid the play-in entirely? Possibly. Does that mean that teams within the play-in field will want to perhaps manipulate their seeding? That's possible. But I think we structured it in a way to minimize the incentive to do that. And we put significantly added penalties for the league office and the commissioner to just bolster that and say, look, if you were to do that, there's even more risk to doing it. And so the combination of the actual incentives with the risk of the discipline, we think should really attack this.
The threat is the deterrent,
correct?
Right?
The threat combined with the lack of incentive in the first place. You're not gaining as much as you would be in the current system from losing games intentionally. And in fact, in many cases, you're actually being hurt by it. And so that reduced incentive combined with the risks of discipline, again, we think is just going to take a massive step towards eliminating this issue.
Now, this is a 3-year trial, essentially, and then it's going to sunset and the league is going to reevaluate whether to make changes, put in a brand new system. And one of the things that's been reported on by multiple people is a draft credit system, possibly for 2030. What does that mean? Can you give like an explainer for people to understand what draft credit system would be?
Sure. It means whatever you want it to. So really, I mean, it's half joking, but it's very undefined right now. I think what happened was, as we started to go down this reform path, we first met with our board. We talked about a bunch of different concepts, ideas for lottery reform. It wasn't necessarily the case that any one of them all of a sudden got a ton of support and attention. It was, we knew we were going to have to make some compromises, trade-offs, but by virtue of, as we just talked about, continuing to tie record to draft position, there's always that little bit of risk that teams see a way to manipulate their record in order to improve their draft position. And so there's this whole category of ideas that got discussed through this process where that would just be fully eliminated. And the basic way to think about this is you completely divorce a team's record from their draft position. And instead, you allocate draft picks based on some new asset that gets created, much like a salary cap determines free agent and trade opportunities, right? And so, for example, you could have a credit, the draft credits that get allocated to each team. And in a basic form, those credits could be used in one of three ways. They could be used to trade with other teams in the same way teams currently trade future first round picks. They could be used to bid on draft picks, and that could be either directly onto the draft pick or to bid into a lottery, or those picks or those credits could be retained for a future season. And so the thinking behind it is it gives teams a lot more control to be able to strategically manage their draft assets. They can decide how and when they want to acquire the credits. They can decide how and when they want to deploy them. It allows teams to flex up or down their use of those credits based on the strength of draft classes. And it should just create a much closer tie-in between the use of the asset and the return on that asset, whereas our current system relies almost entirely on luck.
Totally. And so with this, it would be you would cash in your credits for a specific pick or for specific odds or something like that.
Yeah, so what I just described is incredibly high level. Yeah. There are not infinite, but many, many levers to play with here, right? What is the bidding mechanism? Which teams are eligible to bid? Are we bidding only for the top pick? Are we bidding to enter into a lottery? How do those credits get redistributed after the draft, right? What is the trading model? How would you convert existing trades into this system? Because unless we want to wait until 7 years go by when all of the existing trades are reconciled, right? We would have to figure out a way to convert all those into this system. So there's a bunch of unknowns for this. And I think you'll probably find a little bit less enthusiasm once we start to dig into the specifics. But at least for now, there's energy to explore it. We think there's some viability to it. So we think it's worth the time in this period to study it deeply.
Which speaks to what you just said, like, well, how some teams are like, I don't know if I want to trade picks after 2029, because 2030 and beyond, we don't know what the system is going to look like.
I think there's always a bit of risk and randomness when you're trading picks that far out. Obviously, if you're trading a pick 1, 2, maybe even 3 years out, you have a little bit of sense of where that team's going to be. When you start talking about 5, 6, 7, that's a risky proposition to start with. And of course, we had teams that had traded picks in the future that are now impacted by this reform. So there's already this notion we didn't go there, but there's already this notion that like reform can impact already traded picks. And so I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of dampening of the market, but it will be in teams' minds as they think about this offseason, what that future could look like.
For sure. I mean, and hopefully for Memphis next year, the Utah pick is, they're in the playoffs. It doesn't matter. It's not relevant to the conversation. Hopefully that's the case 1 year from now. But I'm excited for 3-2-1. I think personally, anytime the league seems to put in changes, whether it's the target score in the All-Star game, whether it's the play-in or the NBA Cup, people are like, ah, this is stupid.
Yeah.
And then people start to like it. So we'll see with this, because the randomness will... Here's the thing. We've had randomness since 2019 when the odds were flat, and it's been really random since then. So we've already experienced it. It's just going to be to a greater degree. And speaking about the Cup, we did have Dylan Harper after the Spurs clinched and made it the NBA Finals. Got to get revenge. I'm paraphrasing what he said exactly. Got to get it back for the Cup.
Yeah,
we get our first Cup Finals rematch.
First Cup Finals rematch. So we've subtly done some things. So we have our Rivals Week in January, where we typically feature, you know, recent playoff matchups or brother versus brother. We did a OKC versus Milwaukee, right? The first two Cup champions or finalists playing each other. So, you know, we've done different versions of that. But it was great to see, you know, Harper say that after the game. And I think just we'll continue to lend credibility to the Cup. This was, if you think about it, kind of the Knicks and Spurs coming out parties this year. That was the first big national stage for Wemby and this team to be on back in December. And the Knicks obviously coming off their conference finals appearance, but actually lifting a trophy for the first time. No banner, but a trophy.
Lots of confetti.
Lots of confetti, yeah. And so the opportunity to celebrate, obviously, that we think that just builds. And now the Knicks have the chance to be the first double winner in a season. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we were envisioning when we instituted the Cup, and we think we'll just build over time.
And then someday, inevitably, we'll be a team that wins the Cup, has the best regular season record, and finds itself in the finals for a chance to be the first Triple Crown.
Triple Crown, and, right. And then we'll have our NBA Europe League. We'll do a Community Shield where we take the winner of NBA Europe, come play the winner of the NBA Cup or the finals, mini tournaments. The future is limitless.
Wow. Oh, how about expanding the NBA Cup to 32 teams someday? Well, every team involved, single elimination tournament.
We might be expanding the NBA to 32 teams. Well, but yes, we could also expand the Cup. So we talked about early in the Cup iterations, could we bring in the champions of other leagues around the world? Could we have, for example, the EuroLeague champion and the CBA champion join and have a 32-team Cup? The challenge, of course, is what we ended up creating was built into the regular season schedule. So it gets a little complex when you're saying, wait a minute, an NBA team is playing a non-NBA team.
Someday.
But it could change. And yeah. So I think as we look at expansion, as we look at NBA Europe, there's tremendous opportunity to build out things like the Cup, create new properties that will just add more and more meaning to the calendar.
I'm excited for it all, Evan. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Kevin.
Up next, my mock draft for the first round of the 2026 NBA Draft. About 20 days to the NBA draft, let's do another mock draft based on all the latest intel around the league, starting with the number one pick. It's still AJ DiBonsa to the Washington Wizards. Not a lot has changed there with him being considered the favorite for the number one pick. Darren Peterson, still possible going here as well. Cameron Boozer, cannot rule him out as well. But the Bonsa seems like the very strong favorite to be the number one pick for the Washington Wizards. And it's so easy to understand why when you look at their roster, their needs, what DiBonsa could bring to them with his go-to scoring, superstar-level potential. Put him with Trae Young and AD, two veterans, young guys like Keyshawn George, Alex Saar, Bilal Coulibaly, Trey Johns, and Will Riley. They're just missing a 6'9", versatile shot creator like AJ DiBonsa. It wouldn't shock me at all if he's just the easy choice on draft night for the Wizards. But it's not an easy choice considering the guys to come next. Number two, the Utah Jazz. I'm still keeping Darren Peterson here based off of everything I'm hearing. However, I'm intrigued by the fact that the Utah Jazz worked out Mykael Brown a couple weeks ago. I had Brown on my podcast. He said how he's healthy. He's going to be working out for the Jazz that week. That was in late May. Clearly, the Jazz are turning over every stone here, reviewing all of their options. And this is a Ainge-led front office that once traded down from number one to number three in the Fultz-Tatum draft. So interesting, nonetheless, to keep track of their choices that they're making, their actions. But nonetheless, if they stay at number two, it does seem like Darren Peterson is the most likely choice, given the fact they are already very deep in the front court. Jaren Jackson Jr., Walker Kessler, Lauri Markkanen. In the backcourt, DP with Keyonte George could be a very good fit. And then Ace Bailey sliding right in there in the middle. They could have a very long, versatile lineup. So Peterson gets the nod here, but keep tabs on Utah. I'm just intrigued by some of the actions they're taking with the pre-draft workouts. Number three, Memphis Grizzlies. Cam Boozer, bit of a no-brainer selection here, in my opinion. A lot of people, many of you probably watching this video, wonder why he's just not the consensus number one pick. I completely get it. Boozer is just so safe still with high upside as well, given he's 6'8", with great shot creation ability, great playmaking ability. And what do we see in these finals? What do we see in these playoffs? High effort and toughness matter. And so does high IQ. Boozer checks all of those boxes with his ability to play across different positions, take on different roles, post-ups, screen, operate out of the short roll, hit threes off of movement. I mean, the dude is an absolute beast. And if he's paired with Zach Edey and Cedric Coward and Jalen Wells and this young Memphis team, I'd be pretty fired up about what their future is going to look like moving forward. Number four, Caleb Wilson going to the Chicago Bulls. All right, so this one, you know, not a surprise, the best of the remaining prospects. Caleb Wilson, elite athlete. They need a big. All of that makes sense. What I'm intrigued by is this week, the Bulls, according to my league sources, held a big group workout with four potential lottery picks. Guards Keaton Wagler and Kingston Flemings, and then Nate Ament and Merez Johnson. So four guys that could be taken in the lottery all worked out against each other. Is this the Bulls thinking about pick 15? Is this like whoever's available there? Are they trying to trade up from 15 to get another top 10 pick? Or are they looking at their options at four? Are they thinking about, do we actually want Caleb Wilson? Those are the conversations I'm having with people around the league right now. And I'm curious for you guys watching this mock draft or listening to it, what do you think Chicago's objectives are here? Because there's plenty of people who think Caleb Wilson, with his elite athleticism, with the flashes we've seen him have against Duke and against Kansas as a shooter, people say, oh, Wilson could end up the best player in this draft class, right? That's always what you hear. But then there's the skeptics who say, well, he's actually not an anchor. He's actually more of just one of the guys defensively. He's never really been able to shoot. So there's skeptics. What side are the Bulls on? And their workouts indicate that they're at least looking at some guys in that 6 to 12-ish range. Is that to move up, or is it to move down, or is it to reach at number four? I look forward to seeing how that all plays out. Number five, Mykael Brown to the Los Angeles Clippers. Brown seems to be a riser in this pre-draft process here. He's healthy. He's working out. Everything I've heard is that he's doing really well on these workouts. The Clippers at five, they are not a lock to stay here. The Clippers could very well trade down from this five spot or even out of this five spot, according to the sources I've spoken to. And Mychal Brown seems to be the guy that a lot of teams would be targeting here above Keaton Wagler, above Darius Acuff. And we'll see, though. I mean, we still got, today is June 5th. There's still some time to go before the draft. Things can change. But as of today, Mychal Brown's the hot name in this fifth spot. Number six, the Brooklyn Nets. I've got them taking Nate Ament here in my latest mock draft. Ament is all over the place on boards. You hear him in the 5, 6, 7, 8 range, and then you hear him in the late teens, depending on who you talk to. I tend to believe that there is a lot here with Brooklyn. I reported a few weeks ago around the draft combine that the Nets were strongly linked to Ament and Adai Mara, the Michigan center. That remains unchanged. It does seem like there's some interest there from Brooklyn rather than one of the many guards in this range. It would make sense to target a 6'10" guy who can handle the ball and shows versatility and had an up and down college year and was a top four prospect entering the year, though. Sometimes the high school product matters more to team evaluators more so than just the college sample, a much smaller sample compared to high school and USA competition and everything else, and just projecting a guy forward. So Ament at 6'10", with his versatility for a Brooklyn roster right now, that's currently the pick I have. But again, like I said with the Clippers at number 5, the Nets are a team to watch out as a trade down selection. Teams are trying to move into this 5 or 6 range because, in part, it seems like number 7, the Sacramento Kings, they are not a team that I've heard in many trade conversations. It seems like they're likely to stay here. I can't imagine them moving down. That's in part because they're in love with Darius Acuff. Acuff, I've said it since the combine. It remains true today. They view Acuff as a potential franchise player. It does not guarantee that he will be the pick. It does not guarantee that he will even be on the table. It is very possible someone could take Acuff ahead of this 7th pick for the Sacramento Kings. But at 6'2", with his creation ability off the dribble, we're seeing Jalen Brunson right now in these NBA finals look like an absolute stud, right? He is carrying these New York Knicks all the way to the NBA Finals with everything he can do. Acuff has that ability on ball and off ball. Obviously, he's just a zero, or not even a zero. He's a negative defensively, a big time negative, even worse defensively than Jalen Brunson. However, Brunson is competing when it matters in the playoffs. So if you want to talk about small guards, maybe in the NBA playoffs, Acuff with his 6'7 wingspan and his, you know, free safety style body, he's very strong, wide shoulders, maybe he can tap into something greater defensively than he's been able to show or was willing to show at Arkansas. Number 8, the Atlanta Hawks. I had Tim Bontemps on my podcast this week. I recorded that from the NBA Finals in San Antonio, and I said to him, why is nobody talking about Atlanta? Atlanta, to me, is one of the most intriguing teams in the top 10. This isn't their pick originally. It's the Pelicans' pick that they got. They were a playoff team. They were up in the first round against the New York Knicks. This is one of the most fascinating teams in the league entering this offseason with 2 first-rounders, a young roster on the rise. What are they going to do with this number 8 pick? I've heard differing perspectives from around the league, so maybe it's not very helpful for me to say this. You have some sources who say Atlanta is going for a guard, period, end of story. And then you have people saying they love Adai Mara and they want to add a true center here. I think it's probably something in the middle. The Hawks probably have the guards that they want and then the guards that they don't care about, and then they would instead lean towards a center like Mara. That's my sense of kind of putting it all together with what we're hearing about Atlanta. That said, who's the guard on the table for him, for them there in this mock draft? It's Keaton Wagler, a guy a lot of people think is the 4th or 5th or 6th best player in the draft here at the 8th pick at 6'5" with really a high IQ and great feel for the game. He would fit this Atlanta offense really beautifully, considering the way they share the ball, Wagler's ability to play with and without it and make quick decisions. I think he would be able to play next to CJ McCollum if they bring him back. I'd assume they're gonna. And will also play with Jalen Johnson and these other guys growing in Atlanta in the years to come. Number 9, Dallas Mavericks. I got the Mavericks taking Braden Burries. Braden Burries seems to be a very popular name here right now. Adam Finkelstein over at CBS Sports reported earlier this week how there's a belief in league circles that Burries and his agency are trying to angle their way to Dallas, that Burries isn't taking a lot of workouts right now. This is a very interesting report from Finkelstein because you look at history. Rich Paul, the agent for Burries, the CEO at Clutch Sports, what did he do a few years ago with Dallas Mavericks? He shut down workouts for Derek Lively because he wanted Lively to slip to the pick for Dallas at number 12. There was opportunities for Lively to work out for teams in the top 10, and they said no because they steered him to Dallas because they wanted Lively to be the guy for Luka. Well, what do they want now? They want Burries to be the 6'4" dog in the backcourt to pair with Cooper Flagg, if that's true. And also, it would matter if a team just says, screw it, we're going to take him ahead of time. I had reported around the combine that there was some hype around Burries as the 5th or 6th guy taken in the draft. There are a lot of teams that love him with his versatility. So I do think Dallas would be a sensational fit for him. Him and Cooper would just be pretty awesome together for the next decade plus in the NBA. Number 10, Milwaukee Bucks. I got them taking Kingston Fleming's Houston guard here. Fleming's is small, only 6'3". He's not big. He's lean. He needs to get stronger, obviously. That's all true. But the dude's a bucket getter, high IQ player, great passer. Had him on my pod a few weeks ago. He is an outstanding kid as well, just very outgoing, true to himself. I think for the Bucks, he'd be a nice, reasonable pick to invest in, whether Giannis stays or whether Giannis goes. To me, like, that's what the Bucks need to be thinking about here. How do we want to build this out regardless of Giannis's path moving forward? But I wouldn't rule out Giannis staying. Like, it's not a non-zero chance that he stays. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think with Giannis, there's still a chance that he stays, but it's more likely than not that we're going to see a Giannis trade sometime around the draft. All right, up next, we got the Golden State Warriors, number 11. What are they going to do with Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, and Steve Kerr back? I got them taking the Michigan center, Adai Mara. To me, I think if you're pairing a big with Draymond Green, you want somebody that can help him defensively coast, frankly, over the course of the regular season and conserve his energy for April and May, and the Warriors hope, once again, June. And so Mara, I think with his elite size, 7'6" wingspan, 260 pounds, he would be a great enforcer on the defensive end next to Draymond Green. And not only that, offensively, Mara is a very good offensive player. He's a very good decision maker, quick passer, talented screener, maybe can shoot some spot up threes. Maybe. We'll see. I'm skeptical. He's such a poor free throw shooter, but maybe. I mean, he's teased it before, so we'll see. But I think Mara for the Warriors at number 11 would potentially be a big-time steal. Number 12, the OKC Thunder. Seems like they're probably going to try to move from this spot. There's all the reporting around them trying to trade up. That's pretty loud out there around the league. So these leaks are not coming from the Thunder. That's for sure. Nothing ever leaks from the Thunder. It seems like it's leaking from everybody else that OKC's trying to move up. But Kareem Lopez, if they stay here, that's the pick I have for them, because I think if they stay at 12, what were they missing in this San Antonio series? I mean, a couple things. Chet Holmgren was a total shrinking violet. It would have been nice if Chet could have done anything off the dribble. But also, it felt like sometimes they're a bit too small at the forward spot. They didn't have another guy. Like, the Knicks in the finals have OG Anunoby, right? Kareem Lopez, very similar body at 6'8 with a 7-foot wingspan, already a man's body at 19 years old, 222 pounds, very strong, spent the last 2 years in the NBL. I think he's somebody that would fit what OKC is missing from a roster construction standpoint and would come in and be somebody that could potentially even play a little bit early on in his career. But I can see the Thunder going a lot of different directions here. And ultimately, I do think OKC is going to be a potential trade down team from this spot at number 12. Number 13, Jaxel Lendenborg to the Miami Heat. According to my sources, Lendenborg had a workout this week with the Miami Heat. That does not guarantee that he's the guy here. There's a lot of stuff out there about Jaxel still in his recovery from his injury he suffered in March. Perhaps not having the best stretch of workouts. It does seem like there are other players rising above him. So even though I have him at 13 in this mock, I do think for the people who say Yaxel should be a top 10 guy, why isn't he a top 10 guy? You might be a little bit disappointed with where he goes come draft night, because it might even be lower than number 13. But if he does stay here, this is a great fit for him in Miami. You got guys in that roster that can handle the ball. You got guys like Bam Adebayo that are great rim protectors. You have Khalil Ware as another big in that front court as well. Yaxel, with his versatility, can play the three. He can play the four. He has multi-positional versatility and multiple role versatility as well. And so I think for the Heat, he would make a lot of sense. Even though he's older, he's going to be 24 as a rookie. Even though there's the maturity questions with him, the dude's incredibly talented, and we'll see how the next few weeks go with him. Number 14, the Charlotte Hornets. I get them taking one of my favorite prospects in the whole draft class, Merez Johnson out of Michigan. Very possible that Merez goes higher than this. From what I understand, he is having a great month of workouts with teams. He's very impressive. The shot with him is the big question. Nothing else is. Nothing. I mean, the dude is 1-5, switchable on defense, an elite finisher at the basket, out of rolls to the rim, off of cuts. He's a screener. He's a cutter. He's a dog. He just plays so hard. He is so gritty, just a winner through and through. And he's only 20 years old with a 7'4" wingspan, 250 pounds. These guys don't grow on trees at all. You can't find these guys easily. 6'9", 251 pounds with a 7'4" wingspan. Give me Merez Johnson when he has that body type and the brain to match. The dude's a beast. And if he falls here at Charlotte, I can't think of many better fits for him. From a roster standpoint, when you think of pairing him with LaMelo Ball and Con Knipple and Brandon Miller, that could be unbelievable. Number 15 here, the Chicago Bulls are out of the lottery here. Number 15, Chicago. I got them taking Cameron Carr, 6'5" wing out of Baylor. I think for the Bulls, if they take Wilson fourth, which is the most likely result, finding a guard or a wing here would really be the best way to complement Matis Buzelis, Senge, and Giddy. You already have three guys in that 6'8", 6'9", 6'10 range. Having a wing who can shoot and get to the basket. We saw what Carr did at the NBA Draft Combine, 30 points in that game after a very good season at Baylor, almost 20 points per game on high efficiency. I think he'd be a sensational choice at the 15th pick for the Bulls, and very well might go higher. There's a lot of guys like that. Might go higher, might go lower. It's that type of year. As you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I think the next guy, this is very true. I got Abuka Okori, the Stanford guard, going to the 16th pick, Memphis Grizzlies. Okori is in that group of guards with Filon and Sturts, and they are fighting for these slots. These guys are fighting in workouts to show that they are the next best in the group. These guys could go late lottery, or late first, depending on how the board falls. For now, in this current mock, I've got Okori going here to the Memphis Grizzlies. Ja Morant is likely done. Even if he stays around, which seems highly unlikely, Okori is somebody that they can grow with, a downhill attacker with still, in my opinion, an underrated shot. I think Okori, with the touch he has from in the paint and from the free throw line at 83% from the line, 50% on floaters, that 34% mark from three-point range, I'd expect that to improve in the years to come. So Okori is a guy I'm incredibly high on, given the fact that he got to the basket for 50% of his shots, and that was despite the fact that Stanford team was, okay, nothing special. Imagine him with Zach Edey and Cam Boozer and Cedric Coward and Jalen Wells. Said, could be ridiculous. Number 17, I got Swago, the Italian Wemby, as he calls himself, going here at the 17th pick. I see him mocked in the second round a lot, and he very well might just go in the second round, and he very well might not even be in this year's draft class. He's got a couple of weeks to decide on that. He might end up going to Villanova. But if the Thunder can't trade up, and if the Thunder don't find a sexy deal out of the 17th pick, wouldn't it make sense they take a guy that could be a draft and stash? Or if they don't get a Dime Mara at 12, wouldn't it make sense they take the next best thing at 7'3", 289 pounds with a 7'6 wingspan at 19 years old? Swaggo might be better than Mara in his NBA career. He feels like the type of guy I remember way back in the 2014 draft, was it? Maybe I'm getting my years mixed up. I think 2014 was the year Kristaps Porzingis flirted with entering the NBA draft. And he decided not to. He came out in 2015. He became a top five pick to the New York Knicks. But the year prior to that, in 2014, when he was testing the waters, the Thunder were the team who wanted him with a pick in the tens. Swaggo is not KP in terms of perfect player-to-player comp. I'm just saying in terms of international to NBA transition, you're taking this guy potentially 1 year ahead of being a top 10 pick a year from now. I think it's too low when I see him on the 30s and the 40s in mock drafts. Maybe that's where he ends up being. And if that's the case, he's going to go back to school. But he's 7'3". He can shoot a little bit. He's a really talented passer. Just a mammoth around the basket. Great rebounder as well. I'm very high on this guy, just like I was with Porzingis back in 2014. I had him ranked, I think, in the top 10. In 2014, and he ended up going back to school and very well, I mean, going back overseas. Might be the same thing with Swaggo, but we'll see about that. Number 18, Steinbeck, Hannes going to the Charlotte Hornets. Already had them take Merez Johnson earlier. I think if Steinbeck's here, you're drafting two bigger players, it'd just be too hard to pass up. It'd be way too hard to pass him up with his skill level at 6'10", 7'2" wingspan, the ability to play inside as a really talented finisher and rebounder, getting second chances for this Hornets team. And then the shooting upside with him, I think his touch from the line and from in the paint suggests that that low volume three-point shooting we saw at Washington will eventually become a higher volume shot. It'll probably take a while. It's not going to happen instantly. But with Steinbeck, I think that's something to bet on for the years to come. 19, Toronto Raptors. LeBaron Filon, here's another one of those guards that I was talking about earlier, fighting to be in this range. Maybe it'll end up being Sturts come draft night, but for this mock, I have Filon at 6'3", 6'6", wingspan out of Alabama. The concern with him, he's just 176 pounds. He's so light. You know, we see Brunson in these NBA finals. He's almost 200 pounds. He's listed at 195. He might be much more than that. He just looks so sturdy and strong. Filon doesn't. Filon is very feeble. He's not strong. He's not thick. And that's where I think there's some concern with teams around him. But at the same time, the dude's incredibly talented offensively. You know how it looks with him. Sometimes you squint and you're like, is that SGA's little brother? Like, that's what it looks like. He looks like SGA the way he moves. It's just that herky-jerky unpredictability that is so hard to contain. And Filon has that ability, especially that he improved his shot as a sophomore after going back to Alabama last year. So for him, he got better as a shooter, got even better as a ball handler, got even better as a finisher. It's just he's so small. And that's why he's in this 14 to 28 range rather than a top 10 pick. Number 20, the San Antonio Spurs. We're watching them right now in the NBA Finals. What's missing? What's missing from this team? You're not necessarily going to draft for need, but you do factor in roster construction. What's missing, in my opinion? A better Harrison Barnes. Finding a guy that can replace Barnes. You have Carter Bryant coming off the bench. He's a little bit different stylistically than what I'm talking about. Carter Bryant, more of that just Swiss Army knife defender, multiple position player, someone who can hit spot up threes, attack a closeout for you, but not a creator type. I want somebody at that four spot who can do what Allen Graves does. Graves, a draft analytics darling, but also an eye test darling when you watch this dude just diving on the floor for loose balls, willing to take charges, chase down loose balls, chase down rebounds out of his area. The dude's an absolute beast. It's just teams question the actual evidence of him being an NBA player. Small sample size coming off the bench for Santa Clara, played under 23 minutes per game, low level of competition in the West Coast Conference. A lot of questions there on top of the fact he had some struggles against quad one and quad two teams. According to CBB Analytics, he shot 12% worse at the rim 68% to 56% against quad one and two teams compared to quad three and four. 13% worse from three-point range, from 47% to 34%. And then on Synergy, their tracking data shows that drop from 48% to 38%. And then out of pick and rolls as the screener, 61% to 39%. Big drop-off statistically against the best competition that Santa Clara faced. That said, he stayed in this draft, and there's a really strong expectation that he feels confident about where his floor is. So rather than going back to school, transferring, proving himself, and potentially being top 10 next year, there's something out there for him. I don't know if it's a promise. I have not heard that word associated with Allen Graves, but there is a belief that he has a strong sense of where he's going. I'd imagine the Spurs would be kind of appealing for him to play with Victor Wembanyama, Stephon Castle, Dylan Harper when they're all just babies and already in the NBA Finals. Number 21, the Detroit Pistons. Big offseason coming up for them. They have all of their first-round draft picks, including this one that they swapped ahead of the deadline to move up 8 spots. I get them taking Malik Thomas out of Arkansas. I think Thomas would just be a sensational choice for the Pistons here, given the fact that we know this guy can play with and without the ball. He played next to Akoff last year at Arkansas, largely off the ball. And we saw how much better he was in the times that he got to play without Akoff, when he could run a higher dose of pick and roll and create for himself more often. The dude is a bucket getter from the mid-range, from three-point range, can get to the rim a little bit. I'd like to see him improve that a bit more in the years to come. But for the Pistons, what a perfect complement next to Cade Cunningham to have a high-level shooter in that backcourt next to you that can set you up, and you can set him up a lot, and he has a willingness to play without the ball as well. So I think Thomas here would be excellent pick for the Detroit Pistons to build this out and best surround Cade Cunningham. Next up, the Philadelphia 76ers. They got a new GM. They hired Gansey. No more Daryl Morey. Bob Myers doing something there. It doesn't seem like he wants to run the team full-time, but he's definitely going to have some say. I get them taking Chris Sinak out of Houston here. Sinak is a guy who probably would have been a lottery pick if college basketball never happened, given the fact that he's 6'10", great athlete, has a perimeter style as well. He shows the ability to take mid-range and three-point jumpers. He's just going to improve his efficiency. I'm not the biggest believer in him personally, but I do think for the Sixers, this is a pick, given the guys that could be available in this range. Find a big. You can't trust that Embiid's going to stay healthy or be on the floor. You need to find a big that can play next to Embiid when Embiid's healthy. Sinak could be that. And then replace Embiid when Embiid is inevitably out. Sinak could be that. So I think he's worth the swing and could potentially be a long-term piece next to Vijay Edgecombe and Tyrese Maxey. Number 23, I got the Hawks taking Dalen Swain out of Texas. Look, man, they already got some wings that can't shoot. And do you really want to add another one here? That's my question. But at the same time, Swain does everything else at a really high level. And so if you feel some level of confidence that you can improve his shooting as an 80% guy from the free throw line, as a 50% guy on floaters, if you feel like you got the fix for Swain to hit spot up threes and become better as a pull-up shooter, you might have a star on your hands. We already know he had one of the most elite isolation scoring seasons in college basketball history. We know what he's capable of doing on the defensive end of the floor as well. He's even a willing passer. He's not like a playmaker per se, but he is willing to move the ball. And so I think with Swain, he would be a great fit for the Hawks and worth the swing, hoping that he can improve his shot. I feel better about his chances than I did about some of their recent choices. Daniels adding him from the trade with the Pelicans, and also with Risa, who I was never high on at all. It looks like a major bust. Number 24, the New York Knicks. They're in the NBA Finals. What's one of the reasons why, as of recording on Friday morning, they're up 1-0 and could go up 2-0 on the San Antonio Spurs? It's their bigs, their size, getting second chance opportunities, the screening, sealing off Wembanyama. There was a play in the second half of that game where Brunson hit a layup and Mitchell Robinson just set this hard screen on Wemby, a Gortat style screen to give Brunson the lane to the basket. Mitchell Robinson's a free agent this summer, and he very well could be a guy who walks. Don't know if that's going to happen, but if it's going to happen, Well, Jaden Quaintance would be the perfect replacement for Mitchell Robinson. At 6'9" with a 7'5" wingspan, the dude has a very, very similar type of game with his athleticism, constant lob threat. And if you remember way back when Mitchell Robinson entered the NBA in the late 2010s, there was some pre-draft workout tape of him handling the ball. And it was like, oh my God, is Mitchell Robinson going to be a shot creator? No. The answer was no. That does not happen. But with Jaden Quaintance, we did see some of the flashes in his 2 years in college at Arizona State and then at Kentucky with some of the open floor creation. So there might be something there. There's a reason why he was considered a top 10 guy before. Just the torn ACL, the meniscus tear, and everything else. It's unfortunate those injuries have sapped him a little bit of that athleticism. But if he can get that back, Quaintance absolutely has a chance to be a major steal in the NBA draft. Next up, the Los Angeles Lakers with the 25th pick. I get them taking Zubi Ejiofor, a senior forward or big man out of St. John's. Ejiofor is just a dog, dude. This dude is a hustler, a winning player, somebody that could fit on literally any team in the league. Ejiofor can, with his finishing, he's a bruiser, his playmaking, his decision-making, and his defense, he can switch everything on the floor. I think for the Lakers, he would make a hell of a lot of sense. The only concern with him is the shot. And so that's where I don't think this is a perfect choice for the Lakers. But at this point of the draft with the 25th pick, you're not going to get perfect necessarily. And I think it's hard to find a better choice for them than Zubi Ejiofor. And you might be wondering, where are some of the guards? This is what could happen on draft night. I think there's going to be a guard or two that falls, because some of these teams that are drafting at this point don't need guards, or they don't need another ball handler. They already have that quota filled on their roster. But we'll see if a Christian Anderson falls this far. I have him going number 26 to the Denver Nuggets right here. Out of Texas Tech, sophomore guard, an elite shooter. Some people around the NBA consider Christian Anderson the best shooter in the NBA draft, given how versatile he is off the catch, off the dribble, out of pick and rolls. The dude's a bucket, but he's only 6'1", only 180 pounds. That's why he's going to be a guy who's more likely than not drafted in this range rather than being somebody who gets selected much higher. He could, though. He could. I've heard him as high as number 13 or so with the Miami Heat. So there's a wide range with these guards, as I talked about earlier with Okori, a very wide range. Next up, Boston Celtics, number 27. They went Spanish last year with Hugo Gonzalez. Why not do it again with Delarea right here? Let's draft a tall playmaker to the Celtics, 6'5", 6'9" wingspan. I think the dude is incredibly underrated as a prospect. I think there's a chance he ends up a steal, just like Hugo Gonzalez did last year. And it's just a matter of the unpredictability compared to some of the college prospects. But at 6'5", as a 40% shooter from three, with the ability to handle the ball and as a high IQ cutter, with size, I mean, this dude seems like he checks all the boxes of somebody that should perhaps go much higher than he probably will in the draft. Number 28, Minnesota Timberwolves. I get them taking Bennett Sturts out of Iowa. Sturts probably should go higher. I've got him higher on my board. But as I said, there's going to be guards who slip. I don't know if it's going to be Sturts. I've heard a lot of reporting around how he's really excelling in workouts and impressing teams with his ability to shoot off the catch, not just play on ball like he did at Iowa and at Drake prior to that. The dude always had the ball in his hands. But you look at the Wolves, if they were to get him here, look how important Mike Conley was to the Wolves, and he's 50 years old. They need another guard. Conley's old. Dosunmu's a free agent. Bones Highland is a free agent as well. Sturts in that backcourt next to Anthony Edwards could be potentially very beautiful, given how good of a shooter Sturts is off the catch and how talented he is as a playmaker. So I kind of hope Sturts ends up with a playoff team rather than being drafted up high. I would just love to see a good guard land at 28 with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Number 29, the Cleveland Cavaliers. This team needs toughness, so let's go with Koa Pete. The dude basically is a football player playing basketball with the way he performs on the court. He comes from a family of offensive linemen. He looks like a left tackle, 6'7", 6'11", wingspan. 245 pounds. He would probably be a top five pick if he decided to play football. Instead, he's going to be a late first rounder playing basketball here in the NBA. Pete is a love him or hate him prospect. He doesn't shoot a lick, but he does everything else. He's an interior scorer, a playmaker, and he's tough. He brings size on defense. He's very versatile. I think for the Cavaliers, you could play him with Mobley. You could play him with Jared Allen, and you can play him with both those guys because Mobley maybe can play a little bit of three for you like Jaren Jackson Jr. or Lauri Markkanen has for different teams in the past. So I like Pete here. I'm very intrigued by him, and I think there's a chance he ends up going higher. Next up, number 30, last pick in the first round. I got Jack Khalil going to the Dallas Mavericks with this pick. He was surprisingly a candidate to stay in this draft at one point, and then he shocked everybody and decided, I am actually going to stay in this draft class instead of going to Gonzaga next year and potentially being a top 10 pick. It's intriguing he chose this route because he's somebody who, playing overseas this year, definitely very raw, playing in Berlin, but he's 6'4", has some creation ability, can play off ball. There's some toughness and some athleticism. He reminds me a lot of like Jalen Suggs, not just to stick with the Gonzaga guys, but Suggs was a top 10 guy out of college because of this two-way impact, this toughness, this grittiness, this ability to play with and without the ball. Khalil's got that. And I think for the Dallas Mavericks, this is a team with Masai Ujiri and Mike Schmitz. To be clear, I have not heard that they have promised anybody here. But there's a belief around the league that if he's staying in this year's draft, who promised him? What, like, who could it have been? I don't know. Maybe Dallas. They do need a guard. And even if they take Burries at number 9, as I have in this mock draft, they still need another guard. So I think having a few of those guys would make some sense there. But that's today's mock draft. Full first round. If you want to see the full second round as well, be sure to check out Yahoo Sports NBA Draft Guide at yahoosports.com/NBA draft. That's where you find my full scouting reports for every player in the draft. That's where you find my mock draft, multiple big boards. And then we launched a new tool, Ask Kevin O'Connor, which is where you can talk to the draft guide. You can say, hey, I don't like this mock draft pick. Who are some other options for number 16? Why do you have this guard ranked ahead of that guard? Why'd you screw up on Mo Bamba? You can ask it whatever you want to. It's all informed based off of my own analysis, my podcast, everything else that I've written over the years. Thank you to Tim Bontemps, James Worthy, and Evan Wash for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy Stone and the entire Yahoo team for producing today's show. Thanks for giving us a listen. Talk to you again tomorrow with a special edition weekend show on Saturday, reacting to Game 2 with some more guests. Talk to you then.